body. The lecture today is going to be a bit different from some of the other lectures. You recall when we've been going through Murray Rothbard's Austrian Perspective on History of Economic Thought. He covers a very broad range of subjects. We can be talking about philosophy, theology, history, all sorts of things are in the book, so it's really you're getting a whole picture of European history for a certain period. But in this lecture, is a bit different because we're actually going to be concentrating on economic theory. So you can imagine taking a history class on history of economic thought, we're actually going to be talking about economic thought. That's a bit unusual for this course, but that's what we're going to be doing in this lecture. Now, I want to start off with a point that came up in the question period. Ooh, what happened here? I knocked my slides off. Hello? Danny, are you there?
Yeah, David, all you have to do is click the tab that says Economic Thought.
Oh, yeah, here we go. Good, great. Okay, I almost had an attack there. Now, remember, in the last session, when we're having the question period, Raymond asked me to say something about Rothbard's evaluation of a book by Eachman and Tolleson on mercantilism. Now, unfortunately, I couldn't at the time remember what he said about the book. It was in an article. I don't think either I hadn't read it then or I'd forgotten it. But I've since looked at the article. I think he was right to ask about it because it's a very significant article. It shows some differences between Rothbard's approach to economic history and the approach to economic history of some other economists, especially those in the public choice school of Buchanan and Tullock. I think Eklund and Tolleson are both in that group. So basically, what Rothbard criticizes Eklund and Tolleson is that they ignore the role of ideology in the transition from mercantilism to free trade. Remember, in the period in the 16th, 17th century, the European states were dominated by mercantilism, the view we talked about last time, where the state is becoming absolute, it's trying to control the economy in the interest of those in power. It has systems of monopoly that grants and giving to people. It's trying to build up gold and silver bullion. So then in the 18th century, there was a transition. People like Adam Smith and others that we'll be talking about today were critical of mercantilism. They said, no, we shouldn't have mercantilism. We should reduce the role of the state. So what Eklund and Tolleson were doing is saying, how did this transition from mercantilism to relatively free trade come about? And what they say, they're concentrating on England, and they say, well, in the early 18th century, especially when after the Hanoverian dynasty came to power, after the death of King William and Queen Mary, then Parliament became much more powerful than before. Parliament supplanted the king. So they say, even Tolleson say, well, under those conditions, when, say, if you wanted a grant of monopoly privilege, you'd have to go to Parliament rather than to the king. It was harder to get the grant. And why is that? Well, they say, because if you want a grant from the king, well, you just have to go to one person. But if you want to lobby Parliament, there are a whole lot of people in Parliament. There could be hundreds of people you have to talk to. So it's much more difficult. So Eklund and Tolleson say, well, because it was more difficult, then the grants of privilege tended to go down. So there was relatively a move toward free trade. And what Rothbard answers, he says, well, he's not sure that true, after all, if you want to approach the king, you have to go through certain, you don't just go up to the king and say, hello, your majesty, I want a subsidy. You have to approach various people in court, the king's court. This could be a very complicated process. And it isn't always that hard to get people in parliament to support you. You don't have to go to every member. You would just go to influential people, and then they would have bargains with other people in parliament. So after all, people do get subsidies and all sorts of privileges from parliament and even from Congress. Today we have governments that are elected, legislatures, and we still have a lot of special privileges. So Rothbard is inclined to doubt the basic argument, but more important, this is his fundamental criticism of Beecham Tolson's explanation. He said, even if they're right that it costs more to get subsidies from Parliament or grants of privileges from Parliament than from the king, people don't act just through because they're trying to maximize their narrowly economic interests. So what Rothbard wants to say in his own account of how the free trade replaced mercantilism is that people can't, like the ones we'll be talking about today, mainly Cantillon and Turgot, came up with arguments that were better to show what was wrong with mercantilism. So he's saying it isn't just that people found that their economic interests were such that they could now, it's now, there was a move toward free trade. He said people came up with arguments that were influenced by ideology. An ideology of freedom took over. And this is what this accounted for the transition from mercantilism to free trade. Now, he also doesn't like some other concepts they use that are very influential in modern economics. One of these is rent-seeking. But rent-seeking, in brief, is, there's various more complicated ways I'm going to explain this. In brief, it's seeking special privileges beyond economic efficiency. So, supposing, be an example of rent seeking. supposing, let's take some basketball player. I don't keep up with the sports stars too well. Suppose you have Kobe Bryant is earning $100 million. So, supposing that if he weren't a great basketball player, say he couldn't get paid to be a lawyer and he'd be earning $100,000 a year, that would be his alternative salary. He's making $100 million. So, according to the rent-seeking view, well, all the difference between the $100 million and $100,000 is really just waste, because you could get him to, if you offered him just a little bit more than $100,000, you could get him to play basketball. And so if you're paying him more than that, then that's really economic waste in that view. So what those people use rent-seeking say is that, well, they can identify kind of a cost, fixed cost for good or service, and they say everything beyond that is wasteful rent, and Rothbard doesn't think you can do that. He said, well, just what people pay for something on the market is the price that you can't say, look, behind that, say, certain part is wasteful and the other is rent-seeking. So he doesn't like rent-seeking much. And then another thing that Beecham and Tolson said is transactions cost. They say, just their argument, the main argument we gave, was summarizing their view, is that it costs more to lobby Parliament, because you have to talk to more people than to lobby the king for special privileges. So what kind of cost is that? Well, it's the cost of doing business, and that's what's called the transaction cost. So Rothbard doesn't think the importance of transaction cost has been very exaggerated. He doesn't really think you can separate out these costs very readily from other costs, but even if you could, he doesn't think it's as that important that people are trying to minimize costs, and he doesn't think they're concentrating especially on minimizing transactions costs. So he doesn't really accept what the equal utilities say. Now, Rothbard, we want to ask the question, why does Rothbard emphasize Cantillon and Turgot so much in the chapters that I've given you? Why is he talking about these people so much? Well, remember, a key theme of Rothbard's books, we talked about this, his book, and we talked about this a number of times, is that he wants to argue against this conventional view that's common in many economic histories that Adam Smith was the founder of economics. Rothbard says, no, Adam Smith was not the founder of economics. In fact, he was really blocking progress in economics. And so how does he argue for that? Well, as we've gone over in previous lectures, one way he does that is to show that before Adam Smith, there were people like the Spanish scholastics that we talked about who made important advances in economics. So he can say, look, you're wrong. Economics didn't start with Adam Smith. There were all these people before Adam Smith making important discoveries. But you can imagine somebody who supports the traditional view that Adam Smith was the founder of economics could say, well, maybe some of these people did come up with things, important discoveries in economics before Adam Smith, but no one before Smith really devoted a whole book just economics. I mean, you could look at things like in one of the chapters I did assigned for the reading, even the physiocrat, Francois Quesnay had a famous tableau économique, but that wasn't a real book. It was just a very elaborate diagram with some discussion of it, so you can't really say that's a book. So people who take the traditional view say, before Adam Smith, you really didn't have somebody devoting a whole book to economics. So one reason Rothbard is emphasizing Cantillon and Turgot so much is he can say, that's wrong. We did have writing just on economics theory before Adam Smith, so you can't even say Adam Smith, even if some other people came up with innovation, say, well, Adam Smith was the first one to write a whole treatise on economics. Rothbard would say, no, that's not true, particularly with Cantillon. He had a treatise on economics that Rothbard thinks is much more insightful than Adam Smith that came out before Adam Smith. So that's probably sort of the one reason he's talking a lot about Cantillon and Turgot, because this is how he can respond to one criticism of his attack on the traditional view. They get the dialectic of the argument. I always think it's important when you're studying intellectual history to see how there's a dialectic. One person, you imagine somebody will make an argument, and there's a counter to that, and there's a counter to that. They keep going. It's somewhat like a chess game where there are various figures who are replying to each other's arguments. Now, in considering what he says about Cantillon, we have to ask, what is the fundamental criterion that Rothbard is going to use for evaluating economists? He's going to say, well, some economists are great, others are very terrible. So he thinks Cantillon rates him extremely highly. So how does he decide who the good guys are, who are the ones he likes? And the way he's going to do that is he said, how close did the economists come to Austrian insight? So remember, again, when I said in the first lecture, even though Rothbard rejects the Whig theory of history that everything is in constant progress toward the present, things are always getting better, we're coming to know more and more. So he said, Rothbard said that isn't true there. Sometimes knowledge doesn't advance, sometimes knowledge stops, or there's regression. So even though he rejects the Whig theory, as we said before, he does have a Whig element in his thought, but he is looking at theories from the point of view he considers the correct one, namely the Austrian view. He isn't as much an opponent of the Whig theory as say, Thomas Kuhn or Herbert Butterfield say, when you're studying someone's thought, you can't judge it in terms of present standards. You have to consider it just in light of its own assumption. Russell would say, no, that's wrong. In economics, there are definitely right and wrong views, and you evaluate theories by judging them by the correct views, namely the Austrian view, the one who argues for in his own works on economic theory like Mankind and State. Now, Richard Cantillon, who lived from the early 1680s, 1734, he was an Irishman who moved to France, and he was a very colorful character. He was, for example, he was involved in John Law's Mississippi Bubble, where John Law became the controller of the currency after the death of Louis XIV and the Regency before Louis XV was able to assume the kingship. There was a Regency. So he was kind of a crooked financial scheme, right? Doug French, who's the president of the Regency Institute, has written on the Mississippi Bubble. So Cantillon was involved in that, and he knew, because of his command of economic theory, when to get out in time. So he made a whole lot of money, and he was somewhat of a personally unsavory character. He was involved in kind of crooked or dubious behavior, and he died under odd circumstances. There was a fire in his house, and then he was found dead inside. He appears to have been murdered. Oh, there are accounts that he escaped, but there's a lot of mysteries in his life. Rothbard, regardless of his personal problems, Rothbard considers Cantillon the father of modern economics. And Cantillon is the pioneer, father of modern economics, is based on a book Cantillon wrote around 1730 called An Essay on Commerce in General. Now, one thing Cantillon did in this book that establishes as a pioneer in economic theory is, in contrast with previous writers like the Scholastic, he separated questions of morals and values from a description analysis of the economy. For example, if you look at some of the Scholastics we talked about, some of the Spanish Scholastics we were talking about, they would have discussions of questions of economic theory like nature, price, or value, but they'd be together with discussions on what is the just price, what is the morally right price to charge, or how are we to, excuse me, haven't quite gotten over my cold yet, I'm sorry, but so, they're discussing questions of economic theory together with all sorts of moral questions or questions, theological questions. They're all mixed up, but Cantillon separated the questions of morals and values from a description of the economy. Just say if you look in an economic textbook today, you'll get how the economy works, how the theorist thinks the economy works. The writer might have certain judgments that he makes about what good or bad economic policy, but these are separated from what he's saying about how the economy works. I should say, just because people sometimes miss, it's very important to realize that if you have this separation, it doesn't imply that you think there's no truth, there's no objective truth about morals and values, that questions of morals and values are just subjective, so you don't want to mix those in with your scientific description. That some people thought that might be a reason for them to keep description and analysis separate from morals and values. But you don't have to think that about morals and values to keep them separate. You might just think, well, it's a good idea to keep them separate because they're two different areas of investigation. Now, another area, Canton wasn't the first to use this, but it's a way, something he did in his theorizing about economics that's very characteristic of later work, especially in the Austrian school, is he used thought experiments. A thought experiment is, instead of doing something like you say, you're doing an experiment in chemistry, you put, say, one chemical and mix it with another and then watch what happens. Say, the lab blows up, you've done something wrong. So in thought experiments, you just think things out and say, if something happened, then if under such and such circumstances, then this would happen. Reason it out. So, for example, Cantillon started by imagining that the entire world consisted of a single estate, so there's kind of just one person who's running everything in the world. He's running all production. So he starts off with saying, well, what would happen if you had just one, if the entire world consisted of one estate? Then, well, that isn't very realistic to think that one person's running the entire economy. But what he did after that was keep adding assumptions to make his model more and more realistic. Say, would consider maybe you have two people who were bargaining about price, and then he'd keep adding additional assumptions that more resemble the real world. And this is a very important way that economists work. It's called the method of successive approximation, because what you get closer and closer to the actual world. You start off with a very simplified assumption, and then you keep adding more and more assumptions until you get closer to the real world. And this kind of approximation, an example is called ceteris paribus assumption, because, say, ceteris paribus means other things being equal. So say you have a model with just a few assumptions, say, well, if these were the only assumptions, such and such would happen. So say other things being equal, this would happen. But of course, if you add other things, then things need not be equal, except on the basis of these assumptions, such and such would happen. So other things being equal, this would happen, but when you add, you change the assumptions, then other things might not be equal. So see how this works. Now, if you have, say, one estate in the world, you don't have to worry about prices, because the one who owns the thing isn't buying or selling anything. So, but once you drop that assumption, you have to consider price, because people will be more than one person. So people will have to exchange, and then you can ask the question, what is the rate of exchange for particular goods? How are goods, what rate will goods exchange against each other? Now, remember, when Rothbard is talking about, is considering theories of price, remember he has this division between the good people, the ones who say price is determined by subjective value, and the ones who are the bad people, the ones who get things wrong, saying, no, it's cost of production that determines price. Say, like you could say, as Adam Smith did, that price is basically determined by the labor cost of producing things. So Rothbard is going to say, well, people come up with these cost of production theories, they're wrong. The correct theory is the subjective view. Now, there's an apparent problem if he wants to say that the people who come up with the subjective view of price are the ones who have the correct theory. And he also wants to say Cantillon was someone who was one of the great pioneers, but that there's a problem which he actually is able to resolve, is that Cantillon sometimes talks about intrinsic value of a good. Now, when you talk about intrinsic value, that means the value it has, regardless of how people think about it, it's just the inherent value of it. So that wouldn't go too well with the subjective theory of value. That would go more with the cost of production theory. something costs so and so many labor hours to produce, you could say, well, that's its intrinsic value. So the problem Rothbard has to solve is, if he's going to say Cantillon was one of the great innovators in price theory, what's he going to do about Cantillon talking about intrinsic value? So what Rothbard says is, well, he does mention intrinsic value, but it's not that important in his prices. What Cantillon really emphasized was the role of the utility of a good in determining price. By utility, you mean what people think of the good, how they rate it on their among their preferences. And so then you say, oh, but look, how can you explain away that Cantillon does mention intrinsic value some of the time? So he says, well, what Cantillon says, he does mention intrinsic value, but he thought that the intrinsic value of the good really didn't affect the price. On the contrary, what basically determines price is the consumer demand for a product. So say, you say today, if say people want more gasoline, then that'll drive the price of gasoline up. So the price of something is really determined by the consumer demand for it, how much money they're willing to spend on a product. And then what determines how much the consumers demand, that just depends on the subjective valuation of the consumers. But you could say, well, that's all very well, but Rothbard really hasn't yet said what is about the intrinsic value stuff. Maybe Rothbard would prefer that Cantillon not mention that, but what is this, why is he talking about intrinsic value? So there what Rothbard says is, what Cantillon thought when he talked about intrinsic value or cost of production, he isn't suggesting that determines the price. He says, well, what that's important for cost of production is that determines together with the price whether the businessman is making any money. Let's say the price is determined by consumer demand. So say he has certain inventory, say he's selling baseball bats, so he can, the amount of money he gets will be the price of each baseball bat times the total number he sells. But then when he gets this money, he has to compare that with his cost, and only if what he gets in sales is more than what it's cost him to produce the baseball bat, will he make a profit? So what Cantillon thought was, in intrinsic value or cost production, it doesn't determine the price, but it does tell the businessman, it helps the businessman determine whether he's made a profit or not. So what later Austrians would say, and Cantillon didn't have this insight, was that costs themselves are determined by demand, because really the cost of production will depend really on how, depend on, say, producers who want to buy a certain production good will be in competition with other people who want to buy that good, and how much money they're willing to pay for the good will depend on their estimates of how much the production good will contribute to consumers' good. So it's really estimates of demand can really determine cost of production as well. And if you have a lot of stages of production, this can take a very complicated form. In the Austrian view, it's really demand that's explaining costs as well. So as I say, Cantillon didn't have this insight, but he did have the insight that cost of production by itself isn't determining price. Now, another of his great contributions was when he was talking about the entrepreneur, let's say someone who undertakes new projects. Sometimes in English books at the time, they would call the entrepreneur the undertaker. That probably isn't, I guess one reason they now call him entrepreneur is to avoid the confusion with another meaning of undertaker, of business where you can get in on the ground floor. So they don't want people to think of undertakers in that sense. So that's why they call the entrepreneur that now the one who undertakes projects. So what is happening, say, when if you have an entrepreneur? Well, he has to hire worker and he has other costs. So what he has to do is he doesn't have his revenues till he sells his whatever the good is. Say, let's take my example, somebody's making baseball bats. So say he hires people to make the bats, he hires people to sell them. So he has to estimate how much money is he going to get from selling the goods, because otherwise, unless if he's not good at that, then it could turn out he spent a lot of money in paying these people, his workers produce the baseball bats and paying for the material. He's not able to sell very much, so he will lose money. So the entrepreneur has to be able to estimate future sales. And this is something you don't know with certainty. You just have to, there's some people who are very good at appraising future sales, so they're very good entrepreneurs. So the entrepreneur is the bearer of uncertainty, what does that mean? Well, the entrepreneur is paying the workers, so the workers don't have to worry. They're getting paid. They don't really have to worry about whether the product will sell. Of course, if it doesn't sell, he might not want to use them again, but at least for the work they've done, they're getting paid regardless of how the product sells. It's the entrepreneur who has to take the risk that maybe the product won't sell very well. So in contrast to a later economist, early 20th century economist Joseph Schumpeter. Schumpeter said, well, the entrepreneur is the one who kind of upsets the apple cart. He's getting what he called creative destruction, comes up with new ways of doing things that require us to get rid of the old ways we do. What Kanjian said was, no, it's the entrepreneur is really bringing things into balance, because when successful entrepreneurs correctly estimate what's going to happen in the future, this will help supply and demand to adjust to each other. So he's stressing, Kanjian is saying, the entrepreneur is someone who balances different markets, not someone who upsets things in the way Schumpeter thought. Now, remember, in one of the previous sessions, we were talking about Botero, Giovanni Botero. I gave Rothbard's criticism of Botero on population, and Botero anticipated the famous theory of Thomas Malthus. So it turns out Kanjian had a much better population theory than Malthus. Remember, Malthus said, Botero said before, that population just tends to grow automatically, very rapidly, much faster than food supply, so population is always pressing on food supply. So Kanjian didn't say that, but what he did say, he had the basic idea of an optimum population. And what do we mean by optimum population? Well, this is the population that, if given the state of technology and resources that exists at a particular time, this will produce the most good. How do we know there is such an optimal population? Well, that's an application of the law of returns. We'll get to that a little later when we talk about Turgot. But the notion of optimum population is there's a certain population given the particular state of technology and resources that will maximize production. And now, you notice that when Rothbard is discussing this, he accepts the idea of an optimum population. So this came up in one of the discussion periods in a couple of lectures ago. I think Danny asked, when I was mentioning Rothbard's criticism of Botero and Malthus, does this go against Mises, because Mises believed in optimum population? Well, here when I was answering that, I hadn't thought of this passage, but here in this passage, Rothbard, when he's discussing Kantian, he clearly accepts that there is an optimum population. Now, you remember I mentioned a little bit before that Kantian separates questions of ethics and values from its description of what's going on in economics. He had a kind of economic separate science. So when you talk about optimum population, well, you think from the word optimum, that means the best, but you don't want to have an optimum population. But Kantian didn't say that. He didn't say it's ethically desirable to have the optimum population. It's just that if you have the optimum population, that will get you the most production. But how you rank, say, having more people with fewer resources, less production, against fewer people with more resources, that's really a question of ethics. So Kantian was saying whether it's a kind of matter for economic science, say what the optimum population is, but if you want to say, is it a good thing to have the optimum population, that's a different issue. And this is one theory, incidentally, in contemporary ethics, this kind of question, how do you rank more people few people who are happier than more people who are less happy? How do you rank? That's a very live issue. If you look at a great book by Derek Parfit, P-A-R-F-I-T, called Reasons and Persons, you can see very detailed discussion of that question and others like it. So in addition to talking about optimum population, Kantian thought that population will vary according to the consumer demands for products, especially he thought that rich people's demands for product was especially important how large the population would be. Say if people start demanding goods that require a lot of labor to produce, there will tend to be an increase in population. If they demand goods that are less labor intensive, say that you require a lot of capital but not that much labor to produce, then there will tend to be fewer people. Now, another area in which Kantian was a pioneer was spatial or location economics. This doesn't mean outer space or UFOs, but what this is talking about is what is the most efficient way to, say, to have a particular market, or how will the prices of goods vary according to where they're located in relation to market. This is the area, incidentally, in which Paul Krugman, who's a rather notorious figure among Austrian economists, or people who are, most people, or probably everybody who reads the Mises blog wouldn't like him much, but this is the area in location economics where Krugman won his Nobel Prize. So one example of an argument in spatial economics that Kantian gave was that bulky goods, because that are kind of hard to transport, will be priced lower near where they're produced because it's hard to transport them. So say if you're buying a farm product, if you want to get a good buy, then if you can go to the farmer themselves and buy it, you can avoid paying a large extra amount because it's at a greater distance from where they're produced. Now, another thing Kantian argued was that people will tend to gather in a central market where many goods can be sold instead of spreading out in many small markets. That if you're in one big market, you can look at a lot of different products. You don't have to keep going around from one market to another. And he thought that supply and demand for various goods will tend to adjust markets to their proper sign. Now, you would think if he's arguing that way, well, wouldn't he support complete free trade? But he didn't. He thought that you need the government to guide people to the best locations of the market. So kind of, reading is kind of strange. He said, well, supply and demand will adjust the markets to their proper size, but you still need the government to help out anyway. Of course, Rothbard wouldn't accept that part. Now, Kanga's most important contribution was in the theory of money. And to bring this out, what his contribution was, let's imagine, let's take one of his thought experiments, imagine new money is introduced in the economy, say people discovered a gold mine, and they bring all the new gold into the country. So what's going to happen? Well, those who get the money will spend it on products that they want. They have the money, so they'll buy things. And those people, the ones on which they spend the money, then they have more money, and they'll spend the money on to get on what they want. So what you'll have is money will gradually spread through the economy, because if people get the new money, they'll start spending it on things they want, and then those people, the ones who given them the products they want, will in turn spend it on things they want. So as the money spreads through the economy, the prices of goods that are demanded more will rise. So what's going to happen for, say, people who haven't gotten the new money yet, because remember, the money isn't distributed to everybody at the same time. Some people have gotten the money first, and then they're spending it. So people who haven't gotten the new money yet won't be able to be at a disadvantage because against the ones who have the new money. So there'll be a shift of goods to those with the new money because they'll have more to spend, so there'll be a shift of goods in their direction. And the effects, these kinds of effects of money spreading in stages through the economy are now called in economic theory Cantillon effects, after Richard Cantillon. In the basic point of Cantillon effects is that new money doesn't leave everything in the same relative position, because people get the new money will be spending on what they want, so they're not going to necessarily reproduce the same patterns of spending that the other people had. There'll be a movement in the direction of the demand of those who get the money first. And the ones who get the money last will lose out, and there'll be shifts away from both them and their patterns of spending. Now, Cantillon also had the concept of velocity of circulation. That means how fast people are buying and selling. Say, imagine, say, you make a sale, and then the person who gets the money just hides the money in his mattress, and then a year later he takes the money out and maybe buys a little bit, puts it back in the mattress. So then money wouldn't be would be circulating very slowly. If, on the other hand, people keep spending the money very rapidly, then that's called high velocity. And to some extent, Cantillon said, high velocity is equivalent to more money. And Cantillon also considered, well, what is the effect on interest rates if you have an increase in the supply of money? Well, again, he went to his fundamental point, well, I should have gone back to previous slide, this depends on who gets the money first. Well, if lenders get the new money first, then they'll be in competition with each other, because they want to lend out their money and they have more money to lend. So this will drive interest rates down because they're the suppliers of money. You have an increase in supply. So just like any other time you have an increase in supply, other things being equal, lower the price. But if the borrowers get the new money, then they'll demand, this will be an increase in demand, there'll be an increase in demand, so interest rates will tend to go up, because it's something like they want to get more money, so there's an increase in demand for money, and then interest rates will rise. So whether interest rates rise or fall will depend on who's getting the money. Now, another thing Cantillon realized was there's a fundamental contradiction in mercantilism, and mercantilism, the system we talked about the last time. So what is the fundamental contradiction is, according to mercantilism, a nation is supposed to try to accumulate gold and silver, because if you accumulate gold and silver, according to mercantilism, this will make the nation powerful. People, or at least the king, will have more power because he'll be able to have gold and silver. He can use this to support his army, which he can do various things that he wants. But what happens if a nation does accumulate gold and silver? Well, you increase the quantity of money, and prices of goods will tend to rise. So what happens then? Well, if your prices of domestic goods are high, get higher, then people will want to import things because the foreign products will be cheaper, and exports will tend to fall because prices have gone up, so the foreign buyers won't buy as much. So what happens if imports increase and exports decrease? Well, then gold and silver will have to flow out of the country, because you'll have more things that are bought than are shipped out. There'll be a so-called unfavorable balance of trade. So the contradiction is, if you try to increase your supply of gold and silver, you won't be able to do it after a while, because the price rise will cause gold and silver to flow out of the country. So now we want to get to the other person who Rothbard thinks is extraordinarily important, is Turgot, who lived from 1727 to 1781. And he's one of Rothbard's favorite economists. Turgot came from a family of royal officials. He was himself an important royal official. He was a controller general of finance at one time under Louis XVI. And this is the minister of finance. He was a very big government official. And Rothbard, who liked to follow chess, brings in the notion of a brilliancy prize, or sometimes in the chess tournament they'll award a prize for the most brilliant game. And sometimes these games are ones where somebody will have some very fancy combinations, able to win the game in a few moves. So Rothbard thinks Turgot's worthy of brilliancy prizes. He said he wrote less than 200 pages on economics in his career, but he arrived at a lot of insights. And basically, although there were some exceptions, Turgot was a supporter of laissez-faire, but he was also someone who didn't think, say, as contemporary libertarians do, well, we just have to educate people to support libertarianism. He thought the way to go was to convince the king to adopt his policies. So even though he probably wasn't much of a monarchist himself, he said, well, the king's the one in power, so we have to try to convince him to support laissez-faire. He was never able to do that. So unlike Cantillon, who didn't always favor free trade, Turgot did argue in favor of free trade both domestically and between nations. And one thing I should have mentioned in the previous lecture when we talked about mercantilism, but when we think of tariffs today, what we think of barriers between particular nations. One of the arguments against tariffs, people say, well, if, say, you think tariffs are good to help the United States, why don't we have tariffs, say, up from New York to Massachusetts or something? And the idea is, well, everybody will say, well, that's ridiculous, of course, we wouldn't want to have that. So then you say, well, okay, you accept trade between it within the nation, why not between nations? So at the time Trudeau was writing, people, that argument wouldn't have worked that well because if people did have tariffs within a nation, you'd have to pay tolls if you're going from one part of France to another and you wanted to sell things, and these could be very costly. So Trudeau's basic argument for free trade was a simple one. He said that trade will only take place if both parties expect to benefit from it. You wouldn't trade with someone unless you thought you would get more than you're giving up, and the other person won't trade unless he wants what you have more than what he has. So a trade is always a mutually beneficial exchange, at least from the estimate that people were making it at the time. So that's a pretty basic insight that a lot of people didn't understand that, and Trudeau was quite clear on it. Now another insight he had, he said, well, why not, what's wrong with central direction of the economy? He said, well, a free market can use the local knowledge that people have. If you have a centrally controlled system, it's just dependent on whatever data or statistics the central planner has, but people on the scene have all sorts of knowledge and what's going on that they can't really put in statistics, or in, maybe they can't even put it in words, but they know they have a lot of local knowledge. And the free market is, through the price system, can use this local knowledge. And this insight, the importance of local knowledge, is a basic idea that Friedrich Hayek developed in the 20th century, and Trudeau anticipated this. Now, like Kantian, Trudeau used the method of successive approximation to arrive at a theory of value. Remember, we start off with a sort of abstract model, and we keep adding more and more assumptions to it to get it to be more like the real world. And one thing, Trudeau not only realized that good, the price is determined by people's subjective valuation, he had a very good understanding of what was involved in subjective evaluation. First, he had the insight that when you're thinking about how much you like a certain good, what you're doing is not just taking goods separate and say, well, I like ice cream, so I'm going to pay a lot of money for that. You're ranking the goods. Let's say one good ranks higher than another. And he also anticipated, although he didn't fully state, diminishing marginal utility, which is as you get more and more units of the good, okay, they get more and more ice cream cones, you put each unit to a less valued use. So goods tend to go down in their utility the more of a particular good you have. That's diminishing marginal utility. Marginal is the last unit. So as you keep adding more and more units of the good, the utility goes down. Now, Trudeau also anticipated the ordinal nature of utility. By that mean, well, say you're ranking things. I say if you like my friend Father James Sadowski, say you prefer chocolate ice cream to vanilla ice cream, you rank one higher than the other, but you're not measuring them. Say, well, chocolate ice cream has so many units of utility, and vanilla ice cream doesn't have that large a number. It's just you rank one higher than the other. I see Colleen says, is Crusoe economics a subtype of successive approximation? Well, Crusoe economics is an example of an abstraction. Successive approximation would be you would go with that and keep adding more and more things to it to make it more realistic. So Crusoe economics could be part of a series of successive approximation, but it wouldn't be a type of it. It would just be part, it could be part of a series of successive approximation. So it's Trudeau anticipate ordinal utility or not. You're ranking things for sort of first, second, or third. You're not measuring by unit. And he also anticipated the notion of opportunity cost. What does that mean? Well, what is the cost of doing something is the highest valued alternative that you have to give up. Say, what is the cost to you of listening to my lecture? It's what you think of, well, what would you have been doing if you hadn't joined in this session? And that would be the cost to you of listening to my lecture. So that's what's called the opportunity cost. Now, one of his most important contributions, and this is one, it came up a little bit when we were talking about Kantian and optimum population, but this is really the basis for, say, talking about an optimum population. It applies not just to population, but any factor of production. It's called the law of returns. I suppose you need several factors of production to make something. Say you need baseball bat, you need people to, you need to have certain materials, you need the wood, you need glue, you need people to cut things in the proper shape or glue things together. So you need to have several factors of production. Now suppose you hold everything constant, but you keep increasing one of the factors of production. So it won't be the case that if you just keep increasing one of the factors of production, hold everything constant, that you'll keep indefinitely increasing the amount of the good that you have. If you say you keep piling up more and more of the kind of wood that you use to make baseball bats, when you have the same number of people, well, eventually there are just so many baseball bats they can produce in a day, so if you keep piling up the wood, it's not going to do any more good in getting the baseball bats. You'll reach a point where the additional factor adds less than before to production, and eventually the new factor will contribute nothing. Again, this is assuming that all the other factors remain constant. So the law of return says there's an optimum point given the other factors that for each factor to produce, to contribute to production, you can't just keep increasing the factor indefinitely. Now, remember when I talked about Kantian, I was emphasizing that he said the entrepreneur bears the risk because he has to estimate that what his future sales are going to be, and he has to pay his workers. Now, what Chagall added is in order to do that, if he's going to pay, well, it should be doing so, not being so. I didn't proofread this properly, should be doing so. The entrepreneur has to accumulate property, so at capital, because he needs this in order to pay workers and the other factors of production. And because he's done that, then he can sell the goods hoping for a profit. So the way he assumes the risk is he first has to accumulate capital, and then he pays off the workers, the other factors of production, and he hopes that his sales will enable him to make a profit on the deal. So what's happening when this takes place is the capitalist is advancing money to the workers now, but he has to wait to get his money from the sale of the goods. But say if you ask, well, would you rather have, say, $100 now or $100 a year from now? Well, money now is worth more than money in the future. There's people have what oftentimes is called time preference. You prefer to have the satisfaction from the good now rather than in the future, other things being equal. So because the workers are getting the money now, Chagall says, they're willing to pay the capitalist a premium because he has to wait. And this is the rate of interest. So the worker is paying, the capitalist is paying the worker, say, their wages, but their wages have a deduction to them because he's paying them now, and capitalist has to wait, so he gets more because he's willing to postpone getting his money, and the workers he gets a premium for that. So Thoreau has this crucial concept of time prepping, and it's also the basis of money for interest on money loans, again, because money now is worth more than money later. And now we have two rates of interest. We have the rate of interest in production, which is the premium paid by workers and other factories for not having to wait for their money. We also have interest on loans. So what Thoreau said, well, these interest rates will tend to equal each other, because otherwise it'd be profitable to move money from one to the other. So it'll tend to be a single interest rate for the economy. So Thoreau made a fundamental contribution here to the theory of interest. And this is one area where he anticipated the modern Austrian theory. And Rothbard points out that von Baver, who the great Austrian economist, one of the founders of the Austrian school, who was wrote a history of theories of interest, really unfairly downgraded Thoreau. But even though in an early seminar paper, von Baver recognized Thoreau's contribution, he was kind of come up with certain insights, so he downplayed Thoreau, but Thoreau really came up with some of the basic points on time pressure. Well, I think we'll stop here, so now I'm going to go to the Q&A box, and we can see if you have questions or comments. Wait a sec, let me go to the chat too. So Philip says, so Cantillon anticipated F.H. von Thunen, the isolated state, by 100 years. Didn't von Thunen know Cantillon's work? Well, I'd have to look that up. I mean, Cantillon really didn't do all that much with talking about an isolated, just a single person running the economy. I think von Thunen wasn't concerned so much with a single person who's running the economy, but kind of a single economy that was separated from other economies. It was, so I think it's probably a bit different, but I'd have to look up really what von Thunen says. I think he studied, some people study him. There was one today, I mean, he's not one of the most studied people. There was, 20th century economist Georgescu Rogan, who I think studied von Thunen a lot, but I mean, he's a pioneer in certain kinds of geographical economics, but he's a little off the mainstream, so I don't really have a good answer for you on that. Could you discuss the physiocrat? They're kind of an interesting group, but they had a kind of peculiar view. One thing Rothbard is kind of very anxious to say, Thoreau wasn't a physiocrat. They had some sympathies for laissez-faire, but they thought agriculture was really the only productive area in the economy. So everything else is parasitic on agriculture. And it wasn't, they have various arguments trying to argue for that. It isn't really a kind of a peculiar thing to hold. But one of their contributions was they had the notion of kind of how the economy, there's kind of a flow in the economy. Say somebody would be producing something, and then people who when they produce things, then it's sold to other people, and the consumers will buy certain products, and then that feeds future production. So they had the notion of how areas of the economy are related to each other. In this tableau économique that I mentioned by Quesnay, had the notion of sort of how an economic system works, so he's considered a pioneer for that. But they also, in political theory, they tended to stress they supported absolute monarchy. Their idea was, well, the way you have reform is you convince the king to support the best ideas. So they can kind of consider themselves an intellectual elite. And Turgot was influenced by them to some extent, but Rothbard is very much wants to separate Turgot from the physiocrats. He said, well, you know, even though Turgot associated with them, he really was more of someone who had better insights than they did. They're very important. Also, Marx thought quite highly of the physiocrats, and he discusses them in theories, his book, Theories of Surplus Value, a very elaborate lens. Jesse said, did Ayn Rand have an opinion on Kantian, specifically his use of thought experiment? I don't think that she ever discusses him. I've never encountered any mention of him by her. I don't think she would be opposed to the use of thought experiments. I mean, she had the view that all of our concepts come by abstraction from the empirical world, but that wouldn't mean you can't engage in thought experiments and you can't reason things out. She would say your concepts come from abstraction from the empirical world. She wouldn't think, she thought you don't have a priori knowledge, that there's some kind of knowledge unrelated to experience. She thought all knowledge comes from experience, but that's consistent, I think, with the use of thought experiments. At least if it isn't, I'm not seeing why not. Steve says, according to the law of diminishing returns, the graph in the book seems to indicate that the continual addition of one factor of reduction will not only not contribute anything to output, but will reduce the output. Is that a correct statement? Well, that will very often happen. I don't think it would have to, because one way it could happen is, say, imagine, let's take my baseball bat case, you have to keep piling more and more wood up, it might get in the way of what other people are doing when they're producing the bat. So it could be you just have so much piling up that it has a negative factor. But what the usual way of saying would just be you reach a zero point, so then you wouldn't be adding anything more about that. But I mean, I think you could have cases where just you reach a zero point and you just keep piling, adding more and more things, and it doesn't do damage, but just doesn't do any good either. So I don't think it would have to be that it has to reduces the output, but that could happen. Now, just as I thought she was opposed to Mises' concept of the evenly rotating economy. I don't think she wrote specifically on evenly rotating economy. She had various criticisms of Mises. I think she thought he was kind of Kantian in epistemology, which for her was a very bad thing. There are random economists, like there's one man, Buechner, who's critical, I think, of certain aspects of Mises, certain use of abstractions. I mean, it may be that she's critical of evenly rotating economy, but I don't think if she was, or if the Randians were critical of that, it would be just because it's a thought experiment, would be they have specific criticism of that particular thought experiment, but it wouldn't be, oh, well, you're using a thought experiment, so you've done something wrong. Danny had a question in the chat. Okay. I see. The question is, was the tableau économique the first attempted explication of production distribution theory? I think it was probably the first elaborated one. I mean, you have discussions of production, distribution, and some of the scholastic. I think this was a very elaborate attempt to describe the whole economy, kind of showing how things, production and consumption, were related to each other. So I think, yeah, that was a, kind of one of the first contributions there. So you're quite right. I mean, maybe I should have said something about that. But if I say, you're in this, we're limited to six lectures, so I had to pick out certain topics that I thought were especially important. There's ones that Rothbard had, had talked about a lot. I mean, even though the physiocrats were important, Rothbard doesn't like them all that much, so that was one reason I didn't have a separate lecture on them. Leslie said, did Hayek or Mises write anything on Trigault? Yes, I know Hayek did. He has, I think he has some articles on Trigault. I think you'll find reference to them in some of the footnotes that Rothbard had. I don't, I think Mises might mention Trigault a few times. I don't think he wrote anything extended on him. Hayek was more interested in history of economic thought than Mises was generally, although of course Mises had read extremely widely in the area, but Hayek was the one who wrote a lot on economic theory. He was the one who wrote on Trigault. He was the one actually who found this, I think the seminar paper that von Bavert had, it was in, I think around 1876, where he first praised Trigault on capital and interest, in contrast to what he later said in his book. And I think that von Bavert's widow gave it to the essay to Hayek. So that was how Hayek discovered it and wrote about it. Let's see, the question here is, was there a path of influence with scholastics to Menger? Yes, that's a very good question. Yes, there was. I think there's some evidence that Menger had read some of the Spanish scholastics. Remember, in the Austrian system of education, you know, Austria is a Catholic country, they studied scholastic philosophy, and they were familiar with the scholastics, so I think there is evidence that the Menger read the scholastic. I think Guido Holtzmann is interested in that question and has done some work on that. So I think some of the, there was Eric Streisler, I think, has read that. Now, Colleen said, did Rothbard read the scholastics in Latin or translation? I really don't know that. I think he knew some Latin, I know that, but you know, I don't really know. He doesn't always cite, you know, he'll have discussions of certain scholastics, but he doesn't really cite the always where he's getting it from. So, I mean, I think he knew Latin, but I don't know really where each writer for where he got the stuff from. It's a good question, but you know, I really don't know. When this book came out, you know, I knew he was working on it. He never discussed it with me while he was writing it much, so I don't really know how he would, you know, what he did on that. Was Rothbard a good chess player? Well, as far as I know, he followed the chess column in New York Times. I don't know. He never played in any tournaments, so I don't really know. I have the impression he was fairly good, but you know, I don't really know that. Never played competitively. Now Raymond says, what does Mark Skousen think of Rothbard's two volumes? Well, it's very peculiar. You know, Skousen commissioned Rothbard to write on the history of economics, but what Skousen wanted was a response to a book by Robert Heilbronner, who was a kind of a left-wing economist, who wrote a book called The Worldly Philosophers. It was a very popular history of economics. Heilbronner was a very good writer. So what Skousen wanted was a free market response to Heilbronner. And he was very dissatisfied. He said, oh, well, you know, Rothbard's come up with these two volumes, but it's not what I wanted. So what I thought was peculiar was that he'd given him much more than he asked for, but he wasn't satisfied with something like, suppose, say you go into the car lot and you want a Ford, and they give you a Rolls Royce instead. It would be kind of peculiar. Said, oh well, of course a Rolls Royce is very nice, but I really want a Ford. You'd probably be pretty happy with getting the higher priced car. So that's the way Skousen viewed it. Now, Danny says, did the Scholastic directly influence the later continental school, Kantian, Turgot, say, Bastiat, etc.? I don't think so. I mean, I don't recall them, any of them citing the Scholastics. You know, maybe they did know them, but I don't recall any particular citations in what I'm familiar with where they mention this. I think Turgot sometimes will discuss what various theologians say about particular topics, but I don't think he does that very much. Is there any particular reason you discuss Kantian more than Turgot? I don't think so. I mean, I think it just worked out that way. It was just as I was giving the lecture, I spent a lot of time on Kantian, so I had to speed up a bit on Turgot. I mean, maybe if I'd started with Turgot, it would have been longer on him. I think it's just the way I spaced it out. I kind of have to hurry up a bit because I wanted to finish in the time period I could have. A question from chapter 3-4. Can you explain what a guaranteed investment contract is? I think that would, if I have to look this up to make sure I've got this right, but that would be something like, suppose you're lending money and you want to get interest, but you say you're not supposed to take interest. Remember, there the church didn't disapprove of usury. So one way you can get around that is say, well, I'm not really lending money at interest. I'm really investing in this. This person is going to start a business, and by giving him money, I'm investing in his business. So I'm not charging him interest. I'm just investing in his business. So then, well, the problem there is, you know, say you invest in somebody's business. What if the business fails? Then you've lost your money. So in a guaranteed investment contract, the borrower, who's really a borrower, but he's pretending he is, and he's saying, well, if you say you give me money, you say you're going to invest in my business, I'll guarantee to pay you back. You know, if I lose money in the investment, I'll use other money that I have to pay you. So it's really kind of a way of evading the prohibition on interest. Now, Yang said, I wonder if they read them but didn't cite them, but the rise of national language and light in the fall of land seems like enlightened writers can make themselves seem really groundbreaking because they were first generation who trust their readership didn't read their Latin writings for them. Well, that's a very interesting suggestion. So what Danny is suggesting is, well, maybe some of these people could read Latin and they could read the Scholastics, so, but they then, because they thought the audience wouldn't be able to spot what they were doing, the public couldn't spot it, they could claim originality for things they really kind of come up with themselves. That's a very interesting suggestion. Of course, they have the risk that other people could expose them who had read these things. I mean, that would be certainly a suggestion very much worth investigating. Kenneth says, are you planning on doing a course on the second volume? Yes, very much so. I'm going to be doing that. I don't know if Danny's going to tell me, I guess, when I'll be doing that. But see, I have to do first, I'm giving a course starting March 21st on the betrayal of the old right and rising neoconservatives. So I guess this course in the second volume will start somewhat after that. I don't know exactly when, but I'm definitely doing that. And also, that one, you don't have to take this course in order to take this one in the second volume. In the second volume, as you know, if you look at Rothbard, is going into economic theory in much more detail than he does in the first volume. The first volume, he's giving a lot of historical background and everything. But if you're interested more in strict history of economics, you'll probably find a lot in the second volume that's very much worth discussing. That has Rothbard's interpretation of Marxism and his discussion of Ricardo. But it's a very important volume. Well, Michael can't wait. Well, that's good. Well, anyone who likes my courses, it's all right. Good for you. Wish there were many more. Any plans to do a post 1945 European history course? Well, that's a very interesting idea. I have to think about that one. We have to see what we think the students would want. So, I mean, that's certainly an interesting suggestion. I'll certainly think about that. You know, that would be more down the road. I mean, this second volume course would be, I think, fairly soon. Unless they kick me out of the Mises Academy altogether. I hope not. Someone says here, Andrew Breitbart dies on Thursday, then going down to lectures on neoconservatives on Friday. Coincidence? Well, I mean, I would do things as a publicity stunt for my course, but getting rid of somebody's going a little too far. So I suppose it was a coincidence. But he said he had, there was supposed to be some tape that was even going to, he said Obama's going to be very upset once something comes out March 1st, and I think he died the day before, so it does make you wonder. So I wanted to be sure President Obama's listening. I don't have the tape. Oh, I know. Don't come and don't get me. Oh, well, the in a couple of weeks, assuming the people from this organization are still alive in a couple of weeks. I think according to one account, they're supposed to show Obama in his younger days together with certain people in the weatherman groups or certain radical people that would be very embarrassing to him. But, you know, I mean, I don't know for, just what, I think I saw that in the newspaper. I don't know anything particular about it. Justin, do you think the Tea Party is closely related to the early neocons? I tend to think, no, the Tea Party is more kind of a, they tend to stress their interpreting the Constitution a lot. The early neocons were more people who said, well, we favor some kind of welfare state, we have to have it run better or run to promote certain kinds of values better, and they favored a kind of a certain kinds of foreign policy. Some of the Tea Party people have a foreign policy like the neoconservatives, and others don't. So I think there probably isn't such a direct relation between the Tea Party and the neocon. Do you consider late James Q. Wilson a neocon? I think he would be, in that they usually considered him one of them. He was he didn't write on foreign policy much, but I think domestically. The Tea Party like staunch conservatives. Well, I mean, there's sort of the various groups within the Tea Party. So, I mean, I think some of them would be quite conservative. It would vary with the different groups. There's a new book by Elizabeth Price Foley, who's a law professor at Florida, on the Tea Party. She's very sympathetic. And I was supposed to do a review of a book she wrote that she sent to me on legal theory, but I haven't done it yet. I'm behind. Now, Leslie said, I'd be interested in a course on the cause of World War I before the 100th anniversary, because that would be a very good topic. I mean, in my younger days, I used to know a bit about origins of World War I, but, I probably go over it. Now, someone says, Danny said, wait a sec, are you going to read on the plane tomorrow? Well, I mean, what else can you do on the plane? Of course, you have to. I mean, that's what I got a lot. I mean, I'm going from L.A. to Auburn, so I mean, that's about nearly 4 hours you have to read. So, I mean, you wouldn't want to put that to waste, would you? Yes, I did have, that's right, I did have a lecture on it. What am I going to read? Well, I'm not really sure yet. I usually just decide just before I go. Like, sometimes I like philosophy books, you know, just to keep my mind occupied so I don't worry about what we're up in the air. I don't have an e-reader, I just do it the old-fashioned way with books. I'm used to books. One thing I'll be going, probably when I'm on a plane, I have to give a lecture, you know, this little church lecture, so I might be reading that. I'll read that over. I have it written out. You know, I usually don't write out my lectures, but since this is a formal lecture, I did, so I have to go over that. So that's one thing I'll be doing. Wait, there's anything else? What magazines do I subscribe to? Well, I like to read the New York Review of Books, London Review of Books, what else? I usually read the New Republic. There's one of the First Things is one I read. I used to read Times Literary Supplement, but then you can't buy it at the LA newsstands anymore. And then, course, you have to keep up with the pro wrestling magazines also. I don't do that as much as I used to. Okay, well, I guess we're about out of time now, so thanks very much for coming to the lecture. And the lecture next week will be back at the usual time, which will be Wednesday at 5:15. And sorry for the inconvenience in having it Tuesday, just tomorrow I'll be on a plane, so I couldn't give the lecture. So thank you, everybody. Hope to see you all next week. Thank you. Bye.